Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 9. Yes, you were saying that the Somme, when you arrived, was the countryside was good?
Yes, I mean, there were places that had been badly hammered, like High Wood and places like that, and Contalmaison village had been, but the landscape generally didn't have that pitting that we'd been accustomed to in the north. The concentrated hammering, of course. This was September. I think the Somme battle originally started about August, I think it did. So it hadn't really had that attention that it got later to such a terrific extent. But I was saying that it was lovely rolling downs and farming country almost, with lovely views and marvelous fighting country. I mean, from the point of view of finding positions and whatnot, because you could drop into a hollow, and as long as you were quite clear, you could clear the crest, you were home and dry. Unfortunately, this damn battery behind us in Peak Wood didn't do that. They took the angle to clear the crest, but they didn't do what every sensible fella does, is once you set the gun to clear the crest, you usually swing the breech open and have a cock through to make sure you're all right. Well, they didn't do that, and we were at that time issued with some new, you see, having been in all this mud and stuff, we were complaining about the fact that you would fire shells and they would just bury themselves in the mud and not detonate. There was so much mud. So they brought out the 101 fuse, which was supposed to go off if it hit a bit of paper, and by Jove, it did. This battery behind us stuck in a salvo of 101 shell fused and fired a salvo to check their guns for clearing the crest. And along the top of the crest was a hedge that they hadn't taken into account. And we got sprayed with these things burst above us and all round us. And we were diving for holes anywhere to get out of the shower. Certainly it was very high, but hot metal, you know. So we went round very quickly and said, "Look here, bloody, check your gunnery, you're a wee bit out." And but after that, these things were marvellous, in that fact, these 101 fuses. And as I say, we went in there behind Contalmaison. Our job then was to fire in support of this attack, which was going to take place to recover Martin Push and the bits down below. We fired quite a number of barrage shoots there in favour of attacks. They were trying to capture Martin Push, and they were trying to capture Croisselles, I think it was. But it was down in the valley, and then you came up to the butt beyond, and their ambition was gradually to get to then on to Bapaume, really, which was the objective. And they never really got there until towards the end, and there were terrific fights for these bits. I remember there was one bit of trench called Intermediate Trench up on the beyond the ridge, which was possessed and dispossessed and possessed and dispossessed about 5 or 6 times. And then they decided there was going to be another almighty push, and this time we were moved from Contalmaison a bit further to the right. Here was the road going to the butt here, and there was High Wood, there was Caterpillar Valley and Flares beyond us. And Caterpillar Valley housed I don't know how many brigades of artillery. They were almost hubcap to hubcap, but they were so tightly packed. And we fired there a terrific fusillade of ammunition in support of trying to push on further. Without a map, really, I can't remember my terrain very well, but there was an awful lot of fighting went on to try and get very little there.
Did you notice a change in the landscape as the battle progressed? Did it change very much?
Well, by the time we got round to Flares, the weather had changed. The approach road to our battery position behind Flares was a metal road, but it was about this deep in liquid mud. Awful. We were very glad to get away from there. We weren't around Flares very long. At that time, the brigade commander, Colonel Pickersgill, was a sick man, and my major went off to senior major. He went off to headquarters, and then took over the brigade. And Hector Mack ran the battery. But it was unpleasant. I told you about Highwood, of course, and the fun we had in there one way or another, but that weather changed, and when it changed very badly, and from then on it was unpleasant weather, and it was unpleasant fighting, and it was getting into positions to observe and to support attacks and one thing and another were fraught with considerable difficulty and danger. And
can you remember any particular incident connected with that?
Could I have a look at that history? I could perhaps have... the weather, when we were still back a bit, the weather, gradually we were getting towards hard weather. I remember I'd bought a Thresher and Glennie trench coat with one of these oil silk linings. And the weather suddenly, when I came back with that, changed so considerably that I didn't need it. All I needed was woolly things and warmth. So we were only in a trench so deep, you see, which we'd built up with boxes and whatnot to make cubby holes and things to live in. And I'd stuck this on a nail behind the door in the place we used, usually a few ammunition boxes and what we called the battery box, which carried all the fighting material we needed, maps, everything, and so forth. And the map on there on which we had our gun position and the lines of fire and all the angles and things and the ranges scribed on so that we knew if any got any call for anything at all, map reference only, oh, yeah, so many yards, so many degrees left, and it was all laid on in a matter of seconds. Well, that reposed permanently on the battery box in this funk hole. And at the door I'd just strung my Thresher and Glennie coat up there, and then the weather switched to freezing. The ground got iron hard, and I never saw that coat for at least 3 weeks. And when I went back for it, it was so frozen that it broke to pieces. The silk lining was finished. I'd worn it when I'd been a bit warm, and it got condensation on. There was suddenly this snap change in the weather, which continued for about 3 weeks, and that simply froze. But in the meantime, I had gone over to a position on the ridge where I could observe one day, and as I say, the ground was iron hard. And after doing a bit of shooting at round about the butt and various points that we'd had suggested to us we might crack up for them, I was walking back, and a gun started to fire. And I suddenly heard this swish, and I could tell by the very sound of it, I could tell it was coming fairly near to me. And suddenly there was a burst away to my right. And I thought, well, thank goodness for that. Plod on, chaps. And I kept going on, and suddenly the gun fired again. You could tell the time span. Bonk, another one. It had changed its angle a bit, and I heard this thing. It was sounded as though it was coming extremely close. I hadn't time to do anything. Just suddenly, quite by my side, there was this bzzzt, and about 150 yards beyond me, the shell burst. What had happened, the ground was so hard that the shell had just glissed on the surface, you see. Struck within about a yard to the right-hand side of me as I was walking, pssst, like that, and went on, and in the air, about 150 yards beyond, burst. Now, if that had been soft, I'd have had that. That's the kind of thing that happened. You thought, well, not me this time, chaps. On odds. That was...
You were saying at Loos, you know, the amount of wounded men that were coming behind the line. Was the same situation occurring at the Somme?
Yes.
Were there, you know, the losses?
I remember the wounded men. I can also remember the fact that I can't remember where it was. But I can remember two occasions when, during a battle, Drew went off with Mac for a walk to see, to sort of sort things up and see whether we were going to move position, push forward or whatever. And suddenly pouring out of a dugout, about 50 Jerries, hands up. All they had were pipes and walking sticks. Camarade, and MacDonald, who was a testy Scot, stock, you will have seen his photograph on there. Sure. He said, Drew, we can't be bothered with these fellas. Off, you see, and they pointed and they eventually got rid of them. Prisoners were a nuisance. Somebody had to look after them. We hadn't any time to look after them, so we were shooing them back into... They were looking for the cages, you see, wherever they were had to go. And so just point and say, carry on over there. They would go. And they would get rid of them that way. But it was very often when a battle was in progress and prisoners began to pour back, you would just have to sort of shuffle them together and then do this sort of thing. And somebody else will take you over, boy. You go on and get rid of them out of the way. They were an embarrassment. And with it, of course, there was always the steady stream of wounded. There were the nearest... One thing I think I'd give full marks to was the Salvation Army. Whenever there was a show, they got up as close as they could possibly find some sort of a little cubbyhole to get into and start brewing up tea and whatnot. It was really a mecca, you know, to find these places. But they were wonderful people, the Salvation Army. Particularly, I can remember one that I used to often drop into. And it was a most unhealthy spot to be in. It was at Vimy. And the... we were, of course, away to the right of Vimy. The main road came through Vimy and down onto the plain that way. And well, you didn't take that main road. It was very uncomfortable. It was under constant shell fire, and at night worse. You see, they reckoned that transport would use that road at night, and they would keep it under strafing the whole time. So. But tucked into the side of the hill and that down that road was the Salvation Army in a hole in the ground, and they used to have a tea and whatever going all hours of the day. How they survived there, I don't know. Wonderful people.
Yes, that must have been, you know, a great comfort.
Mm. Oh yes,
to have had
yes.
support,
something that you couldn't get. Especially in the middle of nowhere, to suddenly walk into a place and get a piping hot pot of tea, you know, because it was a great reviver. Yeah. But the Somme country, yes, we paddled around there. We took part in the support of different battles. We saw an awful lot of people killed and wounded. The country slowly changed state from being a lovely farming country to the areas where the battles were absolutely ploughed up to be almost unnegotiable, and problems of getting in. I can't remember where it was at one time that we were coming into action. We'd been given a battery position, and Drew had been up and had a look at it. Said, "That's no place for us. I'm going to find another." So he went off looking for somewhere else, and came back and said, "I've got the place, we're going." And then when we were getting, the country was sort of rolling up like that and then going down. And we were going, eventually we were going down into that bottom for a battery position, but he said, he suddenly pulled the whole battery up. We were in column of route, just tailing up towards this. He said, called everybody up and said, look here, chaps, that ridge that we're going over is in view. We're going down into the hollow beyond it, quite a way beyond it, so we'll be probably well out, tucked out of sight. But coming up there, we're a marvellous target. Now, he said, it's no good starting to go over there in column of route. Somebody will see that train of guns coming over and they'll just range on it, and as you come up, so you'll be wiped up. I'll bring you on for so long and then I'll give you instructions. Form line. And as soon as I do this, you see, you fan out. And he said, then we'll start at a walk. And he said, when I give you the order to trot, we trot. And then when I say gallop, over that crest, as though the fiends of hell are after you. And that's what we did. And it was the most spectacular show. You know, we'd never done things like that, trekking about from one place to another. It was usually tailing along and then getting the guns in at night. But this was open middle day, brilliant sunshine. And we had to get up there somehow.
Was it exciting to do
that
sort of
thing? Oh, it was exciting. Yes, it was to do something different, and something which we knew as a sort of manoeuvre, which was quite in the book, but which we'd never had an occasion to make use of. But on this occasion, it was just a case of, right, fellas, off we go, walk, march, and off we went. Turrot, you see, and off the hand like that. Form line, you see, and the hands went like this. And then the next thing was, gallop, and we set off, each section commander in charge of his two guns, and we went over there at a full gallop, and the horses, I think, never had their legs stretched as much from before, not for a long time.
And it worked?
Oh, it worked, yes. We were over and away down, and you see, we were up over the crest, and down vanished, and out of sight again almost within 5 minutes.
Did you do much communications work at the Somme? You know, apart from your gunnery, did you have any communications task to do?
The communication work we had to do, of course, was keeping our lines running. Wherever we went, we had tagged a couple of telephonists and linesmen with us, and telephones. And wherever we went, they went on, and the linesmen were trailing a wire behind all the time, and we coupled up and found out what we were going to shoot at and started off as quickly as possible. And the linesman's job was to keep that going, and they did amazing jobs, because it was all right being involved in an attack where you'd charge somebody and then get into a hole somewhere and hold it up, and shell fire would be perhaps more concentrating on stopping what was coming up. They didn't bother so much about the main attack. They bothered more about stopping the support coming up, you see, and then isolating those people so that they could mop them up at their leisure. But when you had the donkey end of the stick, where you were keeping something going regardless of what was happening round about, it was uncomfortable.
How about the horses? How did they stand up to this sort of warfare?
It was a sorry thing for the horses. You see, we started off, of course, with 6 horses per gun, and four to the firing battery and first line wagons. So you had 1, 2, 3 drivers on the gun, 2 on each firing battery and first line wagon. But in no time at all, the horses just couldn't stand the climate. And in fact, in certain places where the mud and conditions were so terrible, horses would just disappear in the mud and be submerged. I can't remember when it was, but we eventually began to shed our... The only horses we kept were 6 horses per gun, because that was one member, and that had to be moved quickly. Firing battery wagons and first line wagons were horsed by Andalusian mules. Tall, good, excellent animals. In fact, We had a driver, I remember, on occasions when we couldn't take battery, when we couldn't take firing battery and first line wagons up to the position to, we used to pack the ammunition. Every animal had a pack and carried six rounds aboard. See, three in each side. And they went up like a string of camels, you see, with an NCO in charge and drivers. And the first line, one of our first line wagons, the driver had a couple of beautiful mules he called Jackie and Jenny. And he was absolutely, you know, he kept those animals in sparkling condition, and they knew him all right, you know. Well, on one occasion, taking up a column of ammunition like that, one of them got killed. And, you know, he got his other mule away, and he came back, stripped all the gear off the other one, and he just sat down at the side and just wept. Absolutely wept. And, you know, it was really pathetic. It was most touching. But then we got that sort of feeling for a horse, you see. Even although we didn't see our horses very much, on the odd occasions, well, once we were Army Brigaded, of course, we did move about quite a lot. And because columns moved at a walk, you see, the guns and everything else were loaded up with gear, apart from just guns, everything was piled onto them. And we walked, we rode a bit, we walked a bit. I had one horse, as a matter of fact, it was an American, lovely animal, and she would follow me anywhere. I used to just drop a stirrup iron through the rein and walk off and say, come on, old girl. And I'd walk off to have a look to see how my lot were getting on, you see, and walk back again. She'd trot around after me, just like a dog. And she was a lovely ride, too. She was an American pacer. She didn't trot. She went two legs together and was very fast. And I used to just sit on the saddle wiggling like this while this thing walked at a pace that was normally a canter for most animals. It was something quite unusual, but she was a lovely ride, and at a canter she was like an armchair to sit on. Very, very comfortable. And if ever I got out at any time, so of course I used to get up in the morning before having some breakfast and just pull on a pair of gumboots and a pair of breeches and go and have a little jog round on her.
Did they suffer much from the gas, the horses? You know, I was wondering if there was any sort of horse gas mask.
There
that
were gas
masks.
I never saw any, but I'm told that horses that were in fairly regular beat in areas like that did have horse gas masks, although I never saw any. But I think, well, you could gather the decimation of horses was so great, and they gradually faded out so much that the mules took over to a large extent.
What was the benefit of a mule over the horse?
Well, much more hardy. And, of course, another thing about it, a mule much more sensible. If you put a horse or a team of horses into a thing and urge them to come on to get a thing out of a hole or whatever, they would pull their insides out before they would stop. But put six mules or whatever into a thing like that, they would pull as long as they knew they could shift it, but once they realized they couldn't, they wouldn't do anything. And another thing, you could take a train of mules with ammunition up a track to the gun line, and you might get a shell land somewhere near you. And you'd make a detour and go round and get on again. The next time you came up, the next night you came up, this mule wouldn't go past that place where that shell had made your detour. Knew it would go round. They were very wise.
Yes, they sound more intelligent than horses, actually.
Very much more, very much more. And good, very good, but bad, oh dear, kick in any direction. A mule could knock a fly off the end of anywhere with a sideways kick from a hind leg.
Where did the mules come from? Where did we get our supply of mules?
Andalusia, Spain, South America. Yes.
And they gradually replaced the horses, did they?
Yes.
During the war.
Yes, yes. My wife's relations, I told you, my mother-in-law came from Linlithgow, and her cousins, Jenny and Bob Brown, they had owned a farm alongside where my mother-in-law had lived. And Bob was sent to Canada, and he went all over Canada buying horses, remounts for the British Army. And Jenny went out there and stayed with them, and they spent the whole of the war recruiting, collecting horses for the British Army. And of course, when he came back from there, by that time I was at university, when he came back from there and somebody had left him another farm, he started to breed polo ponies and hunters. And the Linlithgow family used to borrow horses, hire horses from them whenever they had guests up there for mounts and things. And when I used to go to Edinburgh to play rugger, Elsie used to come up with me, and we'd stay at Upper Bonnington, and she would go out riding with one of the local riding masters while I was away playing football. And if the ground was frozen so hard I couldn't play, I used to come back and ride as well.